Penguin Random House Audio presents Major Labels, A History of Popular Music in Seven Genres. This is the author, Kelly Fasene. Introduction. Wearing headphones. When my father was lying in a hospital bed in New Haven, Connecticut, struck down by a sudden illness, and the doctors and nurses were searching for any sign that he was still alive, my mother decided that he needed a soundtrack. She brought his Bose noise-canceling headphones to the bed, and we took turns playing him his favorite music. Over the next week, as we kept him company and said goodbye, one of the albums we put into heavy rotation was Kleishaw Dibon, a shimmering collaboration from 2013 between Ketron Finch, a Welsh harpist, and Sekou Keita, a kora player from the Casamance region of Senegal in West Africa, not far from where my father had grown up, in the Gambia. The kora, a harp-like device with 21 strings held taut between a wooden neck and a calabash body, was my father's favorite musical instrument. No doubt it reminded him of the village life he left behind when he was a teenager. He named me after a legendary warrior who was the subject of two of the most important compositions in the kora tradition, Kuruntu Kelefa and Kelefa Ba. And I once spent a surreal summer in the Gambia as a kora student, taking long daily lessons from a teacher with whom I communicated mainly in improvised sign language. I remember how excited my dad had been when he discovered that harp and kora album, a warm and atmospheric hybrid that sounded instantly familiar to him. Sometimes, when people talk about loving music, this is what they mean. You hear something that resonates with some fragment of your biography, and you feel you wouldn't mind if those were the last sounds you ever heard. Often, though, falling in love with music is a more complicated and contentious process. When I was growing up, I thought of my dad's beloved kora cassettes as finger-chopping music because of the keening voices of the griots, who sounded to me as if they were howling. I had no interest in it, just as I had no interest in the classical composers who were often heard in my house and whose creations I learned to play on the violin, starting when I was 5. Like most kids, I liked the idea that music could carry me out of my house and into the streets, into the city, and beyond. I started by asking my mother to buy me a cassette of Michael Jackson's Thriller, because everyone at school was talking about it. And soon I moved on to early hip-hop, old and new rock and roll, and eventually punk rock, which transformed my moderate interest in music into an immoderate passion. Punk taught me that music didn't have to express consensus. You didn't have to sing along with whatever was coming from the family stereo, or whatever you saw on television, or whatever the kids at school were into. You could use music as a way to set yourself apart from the world, or at least some of the world. You could find something to love and something, perhaps lots of somethings, to reject. You could have an opinion and an identity. Does that sound obnoxious? Probably it does, and probably it would have sounded even more obnoxious if you had asked me to explain it when I was a teenager, newly converted to the gospel of punk. But I think that musical fandom tends to be at least a little bit obnoxious or embarrassing, which is why it's so easy to make fun of obsessive listeners, whether they are pretentious music snobs or wide-eyed pop stargazers, owlish record collectors in basements, or aggressive stans on social media. The term stan comes from a track by Eminem about a fan who is morbidly and romantically fixated on him. Both the track and the term reflect a widespread belief that there is something shameful and scary and unmanly about fans' hunger for their idols. We can, for the sake of politeness, agree to disagree and not to mock one another's musical tastes. But even those of us who are nominally grown-ups may find that we never quite outgrow the sense that there is something profoundly good about the music we like, something profoundly bad about the music we don't, and something profoundly wrong with everyone who doesn't agree. We take music personally, partly because we learn it by heart. Songs, more than movies or books, are designed to be experienced over and over, made to be memorized. We take it personally, too, because we often listen to it socially, with other people, or at least while thinking of other people. Especially in the late 20th century, American popular music grew increasingly tribal, with different styles linked to different ways of dressing, different ways of seeing the world. By the 1970s, different genres had come to stand for different cultures. By the 1990s, there were subgenres and sub-subgenres, all with their own assumptions and expectations. In some ways, this is a familiar story. Many people have a vague idea that in the old days, popular music was popular, and that somehow popular music got increasingly fragmented and obscure. We put on our headphones and escape from the world into our own curated soundtracks. But at the same time, many fans have kept faith with the idea that music brings people together, assembling audiences that cross boundaries. The truth, of course, is that both of these ideas are important and true. Popular songs or styles or performers can erase boundaries, but they can also erect new ones. The early hip-hop records, for instance, sparked a movement that drew fans from all over the planet. But that movement also helped sharpen a generational divide, giving young black listeners a way to renounce the R&B that their parents loved. And in the 1990s, country music became more suburban and more accessible, but it nevertheless remained a world apart from the pop mainstream. Country music gained new listeners, in fact, by portraying itself as a gentler, more tuneful alternative to the increasingly truculent sounds of 90s rock and hip-hop. Often, the economics of the music industry helped reinforce these divisions. Radio stations encouraged listeners to think of themselves as partisans, loyal to their favorite stations. Record stores arranged their wares by genre, hoping both to enable efficient shopping and to inspire serendipitous discoveries. And record companies scrambled to identify audiences and trends, searching for ways to make the listening public a little less unpredictable. It is easy enough to acknowledge the evident diversity of popular music. But diversity is a rather uninspiring term, conjuring up a polite and static world where people have the serenity to accept one another's differences. More often, popular music has been not merely diverse, but divisive, riven by crossover successes and cruel excommunications, rival fan bases and sneering feuds, full of musicians and listeners who keep finding new ways to set themselves apart. This is the divisive spirit I first heard in punk, and through punk I learned to hear it everywhere, even in my father's Cora music, which he loved partly because it represented the world from which he had set himself apart. Unlike virtually all of his many siblings and half-siblings, my father left his country and his family in order to build a very different life in America, where he became a celebrated scholar of global Christianity and Islam. He didn't pretend to share my infatuation with popular music, but he couldn't have been too surprised by my interest in the stubborn and restless people who made it and loved it, and by the fractious musical communities they created. The Bose headphones that my dad wore in that hospital bed were brand new. A week earlier, I had given them to him for Christmas. A week later, we brought them home from the hospital, and they were mine again. I'm wearing them now as I write, listening to mixes of wordless house and techno tracks on the music-sharing platform SoundCloud. This is background music for me, and maybe comfort music. It's what I often turn to when it's time to read or write. But even a serene, gently propulsive DJ set is, in some sense, an argument. It rewrites the unsettled history of the disco movement. It elevates a handful of tracks over innumerable others. It endorses a particular view about how they ought to be combined. Electronic dance music is infamous for its proliferating categories, which can seem absurd to anyone not inclined to investigate the basic distinction between house music and techno, let alone the subtler distinctions that separate, say, progressive house from deep house. But those differences matter greatly to a DJ, not least because they help determine who shows up to the party and who sticks around. Dance music, no less than country or hip-hop, brings people together by keeping other people out. These musical tribes pull and they push, drawing some of us close while keeping others of us outside. And sometimes, they come to feel like home. Literally generic. I'm always a bit puzzled when a musician is praised for transcending genre. What's so great about that? In visual art, genre painting refers to works that depict normal people doing normal things. In publishing, genre fiction is the downmarket counterpart of literary fiction. And moviegoers often talk about genre films, a term applied to films that fulfill the basic obligations of a certain genre, like horror movies or heist movies, And, it is often implied, do no more than that.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?